Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Hello and welcome to episode 174 of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest this week is Paul Dannan, who is an actor of stage and screen and the founder and creator of Morning After Drama, a theatre company that provides specifically tailored workshops to support people who have experienced trauma, been involved with the criminal justice system, suffered from addiction, or people who experience poor mental health. And Paul shot to fame when he landed a part on Hollyoaks straight out of drama school, and he's worked on stage and film productions, he's featured on several high-profile reality TV shows, he's hosted a chart-topping podcast, and at various times in his life he's been a tabloid regular. And over the course of his career, Paul has suffered with mental health issues and problems with addiction, and he's had multiple stays in rehab. It was actually in a more recent stay where he had the idea for Morning After Drama, and where he started to work on that idea and where the confidence to make it a reality came from. And in this episode, that's what me and Paul chat about. We chat about setting up Morning After Drama, or MAD, as we'll call it throughout this episode, where that idea came from, and how he's using acting and improv and community to improve mental health and well-being. We talk about his time on Hollyoaks. We talk about leaving Hollyoaks to move to LA to try and further his acting career. We talk about some of the stuff that happened out there that really impacted his mental health. And we talk about his love of acting and some of the mental health issues behind his addictions. We talk about what it's like to become famous and deal with rejection. And we talk about going to rehab and self-worth and self-esteem and loads of other stuff in between. I love chatting to Paul. It was an absolute pleasure. He's a lovely bloke. He's doing something really special with Morning After Drama. And it was just great to kind of explore that and hear all about it, to hear more of his story, to learn more about him. And yeah, he's a great guy. We actually had to move this conversation a couple of times. We had to cancel and rearrange a few times. And the first time we had to do that, Paul actually got hold of my phone number and he gave me a ring to let me know he couldn't make it and to try and rearrange. And I was so touched by that. You would be amazed at some of the people, some of the big names in the mental health space who have stood me up for this podcast and stood me up with no explanation, haven't replied to my emails afterwards. And these are well-known people that you definitely have heard of. So the fact that Paul, how busy he is and with his profile, went out of his way to get a message to me to rearrange, I was really touched by that. And I think it goes a long way to showing what a lovely bloke he is. Go and check out what he's doing with Morning After Drama. He's got some incredible plans and there's so much potential there. It's great what he's doing. I've put links to the websites and the social media in the episode notes. There's also all the stuff you need there to give Paul a follow and connect with him on socials as well. And if you would like to watch this conversation, you can do so on the Proper Mental Patreon page. It's just an online community and a great way for you to support the show and keep it going and to keep in touch with everything that I'm up to with Proper Mental. It also keeps it independent and ad-free and sponsor-free, which is really important to me. Actually, just yesterday, I was listening to a podcast, a favourite podcast of mine. I won't name it, but it's another mental health one with quite a well-known host. And I pressed play on the episode yesterday. And first, it was a bunch of adverts, all for celebrity podcasts that I'm not really interested in. Then it was the intro. And as part of the intro, the host had to read out his own sponsorship. So that took a while. And then before it went into the episode, there was another bunch of automated adverts. And most of them were the same as the ones that were at the start. And it was almost 15 minutes before I got to listen to the episode. And I appreciate people have got to make some money, but that's not what I want to do. It reminded me of when you go to the pictures, you know, and a film's supposed to start at 8:30, so you get there at 9:15 and it's 9:50 and the film hasn't started and it's just loads of adverts and you've eaten all your popcorn and it just feels like such a waste of time. And I don't want this podcast to be that. I want to keep it ad-free, independent, and I want to keep it going for as long as possible. So if you sign up to the Patreon, £3 a month, you get early access to all the episodes, you get the videos that don't come out anywhere else, you get to submit questions for upcoming guests, and you get to keep the show going ad-free, independent, and all those lovely things. Links in the episode notes. Anyway, that's my sales pitch over with. This is episode 174 of the Proper Mental Podcast with Paul Dannan. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy. So here we are. This is another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest this week is Mr. Paul Dannan. How are you, mate?
Hello, mate. Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Oh, mate, thank you for joining me, man. It's an absolute pleasure to meet you. An absolute pleasure. I was thinking, I
Pleasure
was
to meet you.
trying, oh, thank you. I was trying to think of the best place for us to start today, mate. And we're going to be talking about a lot about acting and drama and performing and creative arts and how you're using these things to help people with their mental health and stuff. So I
Yeah.
thought just kind of set that up a little bit. Maybe we start a little bit with you and your road into this sort of stuff. Would I be right in thinking that you went to drama school, Paul?
You are right. I went to drama school. I basically wanted to go from a very young age. And my mum was like, "No, you've got to do your GCSEs, and then you can go." Oh shit. Oh, no. See, that's my ADHD. I just kicked over my whole coffee.
Oh, mate, the one you just made as well.
The one I just made. No. It's fine. So my mum, yeah, she just said, like, "No, you got to get," because even though these drama schools, they do like maths and English and, these stage schools and stuff, they really, they don't, they're more about the arts, the dance, the singing, the acting. So you're not going to get the best education, really, the best maths teachers, the best English, the best geography, and so on. I think it's, thank God I've got a brown carpet, eh? I think it's always best to do that first at a normal school and then go. So I did my GCSEs, got some nice grades, and then auditioned for Italia Conti, and I got in. But even when you get in, it's still a fortune. And back then it was like 3 grand a term. Now it's 10 grand a term.
Wow.
And that's a lot of money, when your parents, are sending my brother to uni as well, and my other little brother. And my dad said, "Look, how can I let Jamie, my brother, do his thing at uni if, and not let Paul?" And he's got in, so let's do it. And he worked hard, and he sent me, I'll thank him forever for that, because obviously he knows 90% of actors are out of work, and that's the statistic. So he was like, "Have you got a bit good chance? Are you that good?" And it's like, well, I think they thought I was good, but there was potential, and it was all about building on that. And I learned a lot. And then when I left there, I went to a method acting school as well, called the Lee Strasberg Method Acting School in Camden, and his wife Anne Strasberg set it up, and I had a teacher that literally was taught with alongside De Niro and Pacino and people like that in New York. And his name was David Bennett, and he was amazing, this old guy. And I just never realized about method acting how amazing it can be to really, become the person, become the character. And that was so good, because it's the reason I got Hollyoaks. When I auditioned for Hollyoaks, there was a elimination, and it was whittled down, out of probably a good few hundred people for the character of Sol. And I was doing some method acting warm-ups before they called me in, and the daughter of the casting director said, "Mum, why is he making all those noises?" And she went, "That's a real actor, darling." And basically, that that's basically, she knew I was like, I was coming from a real, whatever, like, educated, like, I was into it, I was really taking it seriously, whereas there was guys there probably just, not as trained as me, or not as, serious about it, or whatever, I don't know. But it wasn't just that, I suppose. It was the fact that I did a good job in the audition. The last few were like down to, we had to improvise in front of Phil Redmond, who was the guy that devised Grange Hill, Brookside, Hollyoaks. And I made the woman opposite, who was my mum in it, cry. I started crying. She slapped me. I mean, it was all improv. It was amazing, and he was blown away. And I just knew, he was like, "Yeah, that's the one." And the next day, yeah, found out, they said, "Move, pack your bags, you're moving to Liverpool." I was just like, "Wow, it's a life changer, isn't it?"
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know much about Hollyoaks now, but like back then it was massive, wasn't
It
it?
was
Like
huge,
it was
huge.
huge. Yeah.
It was the
Yeah.
only thing like that on TV. It was the 90210 of Great Britain. It was just awesome, and there was like less cast that there is now, so everyone could really, you know, get into these characters. People, the viewers, could really start to love them or hate them or just be really engrossed in them. And it was Come Down TV on a Sunday, you know, Hangover TV, Omnibus on T4. And, you know, I used to watch Shipwrecked, you know, and stuff. I loved that. And it's funny, you know, all those people, those presenters and stuff. And, you know, I'm still friends with them now. And we're all like the old school lot, you know, we're like the originals. We're like, we got, and it's nice because we're all still working. And there's a lot of, you know, credibility there. It's you know, we're quite respected. Like, you know, people come up to me like, you're a legend, mate. I feel old when people say that, but. You know, it was a big deal for them back then, for people, you know, just all of that era, really.
Yeah. What was that then like to be, because obviously you've gone into that from an acting perspective, right? Because you don't do like go to method training if you don't give a shit about the craft. What was that then like to go into there and then like be catapulted into something of that size? Because, you know, you go into it for acting and you end up like, it's a you're famous then. Do you know what I mean? What I'm trying to say there?
Yeah, but the thing is, I never got to see really so there's a big difference between that and reality. That's another level reality. This, you're working, you're filming day after day. You don't get to go out that much. So you're not, all you're doing is acting. So you're seeing it as the craft. How can I build on this? How can I play this better? How can I develop this character? And they could see this, like, wow, this kid just growing in confidence and they were giving me more and more storylines. They were like putting me just as the lead of the show. And it was amazing. And you get to the soap awards and things like that, and that's all great. And the recognition, first time getting recognized and things, it's great, but it's weird. Suddenly, yeah, because I was never there to be famous. I never did acting to be famous. I did it because I love it, and because I wanted to be respected as an actor and be in Hollywood movies. And dramas and build the British film industry. That's what I'm about, is being part of the British film industry. I look at it now, I mean, it's thriving and it's unbelievable. Everything is great, you know, England, really, Great Britain. The Americans love us, you know. So I moved, when I left Hollyoaks, because I'd made a decision to leave because I wanted to play other characters. I didn't want to be stereotyped, you know, and I was worried about that. And, you know, look at Nick. I mean, he's the Ken Barlow of Hollyoaks, you know, Nick Picardi, Tony. But it's amazing. I mean, he was quite clever because he's a multimillionaire. He's got a job every day. He don't need to look for a job. And I chose to go back out there with 90% of actors out of work. So what, you know, my dad's like, you're mad. You're earning more money than me. You finally did. But, you know, you proved me wrong. You did it. You made me proud. I'd sent you to drama school and you actually achieved it. And now you want to leave it? But I was engaged to a girl in London. I was missing that, missing being with her. And I think, you know, for me, the job just got a little bit like, I don't know, maybe I just got a bit bored of it. But maybe my mental health, I think, if we really look at it now in reflection, I think the truth is, and I've never said this to anyone, I think my head started to get bad. I think I started to get a little bit worse for wear, because we were partying when we had a day off. You know, we all got together and we'd meet up and we'd have a night on it and we'd have the day off next day. So it'd be all right, you know. But when you start to go in yourself and be a bit depressed and lonely from the drugs and from the partying and then go to work suddenly has a different lens. The lens that I'm looking at work now was a different lens. It was, the vision was different, and I was looking at it and I wasn't happy, and I thought, I'm not happy, I need to get out of this. And I don't know. People had left. Some people, I suppose, I then at that time, I think I was I was living on my own, but then I moved in with some of the other boys. But it was just, yeah, it wasn't the same as it was in the beginning, I suppose. Maybe that, and I don't know if that love for it went because of the addiction or on my head, the mental side of it, or it went because I just fell out of love with it. Yeah. And I genuinely was worried that I was, you know, what more can happen with this character? I'm an actor. I want to play other roles. My goal is to go to America. When am I going to do that? You know, yeah, the money's great, but when you've got money, you don't think about that. You know, it was football and money every week. It was crazy, and I wasn't spending it. So, you know, I bought a house, this, that, and the other. I mean, it's amazing. But you know, I'm like 20-something years old, 21 years, 22 years old, like so young. So anyway, I left and I went to America and I got a manager and an agent, James Gandolfini's manager from The Sopranos and Mr. Big, Chris Noth from Sex and the City. Mark Armstrong, his name, is the manager. And an amazing guy, and auditioned like mad and got so close to so many things. And one time I got this film called Cheaper by the Dozen with Steve Martin. And I was playing the boyfriend of this Hilary Duff. And he had just filmed Just Married with Ashton Kutcher. And he bumped into him the day before that we were going to start shooting. And he said, look, I've got this guy, he's English, but if you want to play it, of course, Ashton, you can. And Ashton went, yeah, man, I'll do you a favor. I'll play it. They phoned me up and they said, sorry, Paul, Ashton's going to do it. And I was just sick to my stomach, and that rejection, that pain, you know, the first thing I do is just, you know, I don't know, go and have a joint or whatever, and you know, and I just started to get really low, and I thought, why is it not happening? But I knew it wasn't happening because of the using, because you can't party and do well, and I was being sold as the new Jude Law and this, that, and the other. And, you know, I could have probably done better, but the American accent I found hard, and they wanted English actors to do the American accent. So there was very few English speaking roles, like with my accent. But with this, the Steve Martin film, there were, you know, I could be me, and that's why I smashed it. Anyone that way I could just be my accent, I smashed. And I got this Cruel Intentions 3. That was all right. Did another series, but nothing made me. So I came back. My mum was like, you're getting skinnier. You look browner, but that's about it. You spent about 100 grand. What the fuck's going on? This is 3 years later. You know, come home. And I was like, okay. And I came home, and then my agent phoned me and said, look, there's this thing called Celebrity Love Island. They just want you to go on this island. Will you do it? And I said, well, who am I playing? They went, no one. You're going to play yourself. So what do you mean? They said, no, you're just you, Paul. Oh, right. Okay. What the fuck's that about? And that was the beginning of reality TV. And I went for it. I got it. Ended up in Fiji. And the rest is history, man. I've never become so famous in all my life. And I didn't train and do all that craft to get to that. I didn't want to be that type of fame. I wanted to be respected in Hollywood, in America, or in England.
Yeah, the rejection thing is really interesting to me, Paul, as well, you know, because it's like, that's brutal, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't really matter what you do for a living, right? Whether you're like applying for a job and you don't get it and you really wanted that job, that sucks and it's hard to deal with. But there are certain, particularly in the arts, I think, where you've got no choice but to just keep, like, you know, you're going to get more knockbacks than you are jobs. That's the nature of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it doesn't make it any easier to take.
Yeah, but I choose the job of rejection, you know, because I'm constantly going for auditions and 9 times out of 10 being rejected.
So hard not to take it personally. I get it when I sometimes ask people on this podcast and they say no, and it's wounding, man. I'm like, you know, do you not see what I'm trying to do here? I'm trying to do this thing. I'm trying to help people. And, you know, knockback is tough, isn't it? It's really, really tough. It's hard not to take it personally, I think.
Yeah, that's it. And like, I got the good thing about with the acting auditions, I did get used to it. I had to, otherwise there's no point being in this field. I had to actually, you know, be like, look, man, you're not going to get them all. You might not have been the right person for it. Your face just didn't fit. It's not that you're shit, you know, and I kind of got to that understanding. And then, you know, I've had many jobs where they were just given to me without auditioning because of my repertoire. But at the same time, the ones that I really wanted and got so close to, like another one with Orlando Bloom, it was called The Calcium Kid, and with Omid Jalili, and basically he's a kid that drinks a lot of milk, and he's built like, you know, he's just and becomes a boxer, and I did so amazing with it. I got down to the final two, and then they gave me the part, and I was just like so excited. It was with Working Title, who did Four Weddings and a Funeral. And the casting director is amazing, Gina Jay, and she's done many films. And she, I'd seen him play The Hobbit and said to Orlando, look, I've got this guy, Paul, blah, blah, blah. I've given him the role, but obviously, you know, you've blown up since the what's it called? The Lord of the Rings.
Lord of the Rings, yeah.
Do you want to play it? And he said, yeah, all right. And again, she had to write to me and say, Paul, I'm really sorry. We've got Orlando doing this. Oh, and it was Billy as well, wasn't it? And, you know, I just, that's the thing. It's like, that really upset me, that, because you've given me the role. It's not like I've even down to the last two. But because of their stature, I wasn't. So who's going to give me that chance?
Yeah, there's a real unfairness about it that is hard to shake off, isn't there?
Yeah. But I really had to get thick-skinned, you know, if I was going to, you know, carry on. And I do now. And now, like, you know, do you know what the truth is now? I find it hard to even get in the room, to even get called for an audition. Like, I get auditions, but, because I'm doing what I'm doing with my theatre company, that serves me. It pleases me so much to help other people that are struggling, and to come up with that amazing idea of like, well, actually acting is a great escapism and a great way of, forgetting about your stuff for a few hours. You can become someone else. You know, it's kind of why I was probably an actor, because I didn't want to look at me. You know, I play someone else all the time. So, yeah, the reality thing just ended up, it was just money, and it's just a chance to just, you know, and that becomes addictive because it's a lot of money. And then whereas, you know, with the acting, you know, you earn a few grand, with that you earn tens of grands, you know, and it's difficult to say no. But it gets in the way of the casting directors taking you seriously. And I think that's what's caused the problem of getting me in the room. Also, yeah, the very well publicized mental health stuff is maybe a thing that casting directors worry about. But there's a few people that I've worked with that really do not care and give me the opportunity. And at the moment, I'm filming a show called The Slip, which is a drama for Amazon Prime, and it's with kids. I run a place called The Slip, where kids that are ADHD or autism or problems that can't be in school, they come to an alternative place called The Slip, and I run it. And I'm a guy called Danny Rye, who's been in a gang, who's been through drugs and prison and turned his life around and opened this center, which is all full of music and arts. And it gives these kids a chance to come there instead. And I'm their counselor. And it's a great show, and it's actually run by a company that all have people with problems, and they teach them how to film, how to do sound, how to do direct, how to do this, how to write. So each episode is written by all these autistic and ADHD people. Plus, that's the crew, and then plus the cast is mostly got problems, and they didn't hire me because of my problems. They just wanted me anyway, but it just worked out. So it's amazing. And that's why they got funding for it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, that's sick. There's that strange, like, kind of parallel there as well, with you playing a character who's helping people, and then in real life you're also doing that with a theatre company as well.
Absolutely.
That's how cool is that?
But also, it's the opposite to why casting directors don't want me in. Because they don't want me in because of my problems, but these people want me in because of my problems.
Yeah, that's...
Because they're empathetic, because they understand, and they know we're the best fucking actors. The ones that are so creative and so out there with their minds, rather than just someone that just, you know, is completely normal. I mean, great, I'd love to be normal, but also I wouldn't. I don't think I would. I like that, you know. Yeah, it comes with pain a lot of the time. Because, you know, my whole thing is that ADHD is the underlying cause of addiction. You have less dopamine, you have less good feeling, so you search constantly for that good hit, that need for to feel good, because there's a lack of it. I've waffled loads.
No, not at all. That's why we're here. Something I always like to ask creative people is, do you think that there is like a kind of link between mental health stuff and being a creative person, right? So I'm a creative person, and I'm a creative person because I think and feel very, very deeply about things. And because of that, that's linked in with my mental health stuff, right? Well, and I kind of feel like I can't have one without the other. Does that kind of make sense to you?
You can't, absolutely. I mean, look at all the people that, you know, out there that are so creative and geniuses, you know, Heath Ledger, River Phoenix, you know, Brittany Murphy, Britney Spears, fucking all of these geniuses, all these Michael Jackson, Prince, they're all got mental health issues. But they are all absolute geniuses. Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Amy Winehouse. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on. And the creativeness in these people, because of the fact that they are a little bit different to your, you know, and I believe that we're not on that level, but we've got that too. I don't know what you have or what you suffer with, or if you do at all have anything, or have you been through stuff, Tom?
All this podcast came around because of my own sort of, the reason it's called Proper Mental is because I thought I was going mad. That's how I described it when I didn't know what was up with me. I've had problems with depression and anxiety and suicidal ideation and stuff like that. So that's how this came about, was me trying to explore that, because it was so lonely and I didn't know anything about it. So I wanted to start asking people about it to try and learn a bit more about what other people had been through, you know, to find that relatable ground, you know?
Yeah. And that's it. I think connection is the answer. Connection with like-minded people is the answer. Connection with people that understand you, so you can then not feel alone. You know, loneliness is the worst thing for me. And I've felt really lonely lately. And I actually went to the doctors yesterday and I said, I don't know what's going on with me. And he gave me something for anxiety and depression. And I didn't think that I was going to even go to that, because I thought that just having the ADHD tablets would help, but they're not. This exclusive right there, but I don't care, because I'm really honest about what's going on with me. And I do get really down, and I just couldn't handle it anymore. So I went yesterday and I feel like better for doing it, really. But I do feel a bit, I just feel upset that it's had to come to that, but I've got to do something about it, because for my little boy, I can't go downhill anymore.
Yeah. And it's such strange, isn't it? Cause when you kind of do some work in the mental health space, and we get so used to saying, you know, go and ask for help, go do something about it early before it gets too bad. We say all these things, but even though you say it and you know it's right, sometimes knowing you have to do it yourself is still the hardest thing, isn't it? You know, it's still so tough.
Completely.
Yeah, I went back on my medication last summer, and I made such a song and dance about going to the doctor. It took me weeks. I should have gone months before to go to the doctor, you know?
Yeah, I should have, because I actually feel better already for doing it. You know, and it took a lot of persuasion from my son's mum and my mum and dad, and and stuff. And as my brothers don't even know, no one knows. I can't believe I'm telling you, but like, you know, but yeah, I just thought I need to sort it because I'm helping all these people and I can give. And then I'm the one fucked. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's a real thing that people have to learn the hard way, I think, particularly working when you start doing things that supports others. Like you say, it's give, but there's got to be something left, right? You've got to have a cup to pour from to be able to help and support.
That's it. And I thought if I carry on, it's going to, you know, be detriment to me being able to carry on helping them. So I made that choice and made that move. And yeah, man, I'm really glad that I did, actually. And I urge anyone to ask for help and just to, because it's a lot of pride and ego and all that stuff. And it's like, no, I'll sort it. I'll be all right. But, you know, I just couldn't. I was just getting really, I wanted to just stay in bed all day. And I don't want to do that. I've done that. I've been there. And I used to be on antidepressants years ago, and I thought, oh, I'll never, ever take them again, you know, because I wanted to feel. So at least I told him that, and he's given me something that isn't going to completely numb me, but more for anxiety, you know, because there's a lot of fear around rejection, around fear around not succeeding, and financial insecurity and stuff and things like that. And yeah, like we went for a lottery grant recently, didn't get it, which I thought we would. And that's the problem, right? With expectations. I learned this. I used to do a class at the Priory about expectations. And the thing is, the only way to do things is to never expect anyone to say what you want them to say or anything to happen that you want to happen. But you, so you don't ever expect it, but you can always, you know, want it to be. But then if you don't expect it and it happens, then obviously it's amazing. But you will never get hurt if you don't expect. And it's hard because sometimes, you know, you automatically expect them to say thank you when you hold a door open, or someone to say sorry when they cut you up, or, you know, and it doesn't happen. So I end up getting hurt because I expect it, or I expected the lottery to give us money. I shouldn't have. I should have just thought, well, they probably won't. Or if it happens, great. But it's not, you know, I'll be okay if it doesn't, because I don't expect it to turn out. I mean, the great thing is there's an opportunity to still go for it again with the advice that they've given us and what they did like and didn't like. So yeah, I developed a company called MAD. And you said proper mental, it's what you thought you were going mad. Well, we're all a bit mad, exactly. Morning after drama, just like my podcast, The Morning After. Which is really successful about you know, mental health and the arts, and I teach people acting, man, proper method acting as well, and they really are, like, some of them are amazing. They've got so good, and they've never acted in their lives, but it's a chance for them to escape for a few hours and become someone else, and they love it, and it's really successful. We're in all the rehabs in Weston-super-Mare. We're also in Bristol and Oxford, and we help in schools and prisons and people on probation. So it's great, and I do it for free in the community. So yeah, I just want it to grow and spread it everywhere.
Yeah, where did that idea come from, Paul? Where did that sort of, how did that start to grow and turn into a thing?
Yeah, well, I was in treatment, and I had no confidence. And this yoga teacher took us for a walk, and she just said, "Well, what do you want to do then?" And I said, "Well, I don't know. I want to teach acting. I used to teach kids and stuff, but I don't want to do that. I want to do adults." And then I was like, "Maybe I want to do adults that have got problems like me. Adults in addiction, adults with mental health problems, adults with ADHD, because it's a really nice outlet." And she went, "Well, go and do it." I said, "But I ain't got the confidence. How am I going to do it?" She said, go on. "What did you do when you were younger? How did you get Hollyoaks?" I said, I had no fear then. I had the confidence in the world. I used to knock on doors. She went, "Well, go and knock on some doors." So I went, "Yeah, fuck it." And I got a load of numbers, local drug agencies, drug and alcohol, local mental health places, told them about my idea, and they loved it. and I moved to Bristol to a dry house, created it there, and then got the BBC involved, Bristol Live, sorry, and the Beeb in the end, but Bristol Live, Bristol Post. I hired a hall, advertised it for people with mental health problems that want to do a bit of confidence building and want to do a bit of acting and become part of a theatre company. So you don't have to be an actor. You could be good at stage direction, hair and makeup, set design, you know, arts, creative writing, anything to do that incorporates a theatre company. If you've got problems and you want to, you know, do something, get out your house after lockdown, come and join us for free.
Mate, that's incredible, huh? Yeah, you must see some real changes in people, right? Because it
real nutters, I thought you were going to say.
Yeah, you must see some real
mad
bastards.
Man. It's yeah. Off the chain.
No, but like, I think you got to be like, particularly if you're going through something, really. Like, yeah. Often the hardest part is walking through the door.
Honestly, yeah.
But like, to then go and act as well, yeah, that's another level of bravery. Yeah.
Yeah. So most of the rehabs I do, because a lot of them, like, you know, it's like they're there because they're there. It's their class. They're like, I'm doing it, mate. I'm getting up. I'm like, yeah, yeah. Listen, you don't have to. You can just watch. It's fine. There's no obligation. They're always the ones by the end of the class that are the best, that are up and doing the most amazing scenes. The ones that say they don't want to do it. It's unbelievable how. But because I reverse psychology it with them and say, no, you don't have to. They see everyone else up and they go, oh, actually, maybe I've got an idea for this. And they get up and they end up becoming the best actors or the best creative writers or whatever, because I do a bit of that. And one woman, she couldn't even say her name. She said her name and started crying. She was so full of fear. And within a few weeks, man, the change, honestly, the transformation in these people. I had two women. They didn't leave their house for years. And lockdown happened. It was a nightmare. They are now like French and Saunders. They're hilarious. They're doing other groups. They're more sociable. They're like, can't wait. They travel miles to come. They're just totally different people. And they honestly, they say it because of the drama, because of coming to MAD, to Morning After Drama, and doing the theatre stuff. They said it's changed their lives.
Wow, that's incredible. What do you think it is about the... about the performance element and the drama element. Why is that so good for people, do you think?
I think it's when they get up and they realise that they've got this amazing, you know, imagination. Because I always wanted to do it with kids to get them off the computers, off the Xbox. And I don't want my kids in the, you know, being on Xbox and all that. I want them, you know, using their imaginations like we used to have to. I want them riding around after school on their bike and playing skateboard and being outside and being creative and coming up with games. And I think it's a chance for people to become kids again, to really get creative and use their imaginations and to actually outlet all their shit and get it out, get angry, get dramatic, you know, pour your heart into it, get laugh. The some of the scenes are hilarious. You know, and when they get the applaud and the accolade, they love it. And by the end of it, they're like, wow, they can't believe that they were able to do that. So, you know, when you do something, you think, wow, I didn't know I had that in me. You know, they become proud of themselves.
Mate, that's lovely. There's like, we're as a society, we're quite a repressed bunch, right? And there's, especially as an adult, there's not many opportunities where you can kind of go into a room and just, like you say, just pretend to be something else and let that stuff out.
Kids do it
all the time, don't they? Kids do it just, you know, all the time. And like, there's something about tapping into that part of us that society wants us to push down and ignore, so we can all like be on the treadmill of life, right?
Because it's so easy to go home, put on the telly or go on your phone or whatever. How are you using that side of the brain that's creative and imaginative and kiddie-like? You know, you're just not. And then also they're relating. So I do a check-in. So I also do a bit of therapy with them. if they've got some stuff going on, we talk about it. Everyone's there and everyone's like-minded. There's no judgment. It's all confidential. So they have that side of it as well. They also have a warm-up, which is really good for exercise and muscles. And then they have a bit of voice coaching and we do a little bit of articulation. And then they do the practical stuff where they actually create a play or whatever and become a character and I'll produce it or whatever. And then they get to work alongside people that they trust. So there's so many segments that work. It's just a win-win formula. And they get taught by someone that they used to watch on the telly. They fucking love it for free.
Yeah, that's sick, isn't it? You know, I suppose there's so much there, isn't it? There's, you know, this purpose, this friendship, this community, all these like underlying basics of wellness that are all getting ticked in one go.
And they get to hang out. They got a WhatsApp group. They all hang out with each other. They go to theatre together. They go and watch plays. They go to for coffee. They go, yeah, honestly, they all become best friends. I love it. I love seeing it. I love seeing me bringing a group of people that didn't know each other together.
Yeah, that's so lovely, mate.
You know, and you have to be really careful with the boundaries because then they could start calling you and this and that. And, you know, and you've got to be careful because I'm not a counsellor. I'm not a therapist, but I do have a wealth of experience. But the good thing is I get to share some of my stuff as well because I kind of trust them. And, you know, it's a chance for me to, but I have to be well to do it, to maintain it. But I need the government involved. I need more funding. I need to be able to get more help with it, man. So I really, you know, I urge if anyone's listening to this that is interested, you know, morningafterdrama.com, please get in touch.
Yeah, I think that's such a powerful thing, isn't it? In like when we're in a situation at the moment where, you know, like the government doesn't seem to care and waiting lists are through the roof and all these stuff. It's what I'm learning to the more people I speak to this podcast is people doing it for themselves and saying, right, we'll go out and we're going to find funding and we're going to find things and we're going to look after our own communities, that we're going to set up these CICs and these charities and these organizations. And people, there's something so empowering and inspiring about people doing that, about like what you're doing with this. And, you know, that seems to me, that's the way, isn't it? The way forward with helping mental health stuff.
It is. And it really is. And I just hope that, you know, soon we get more recognition. I think, I need to keep doing advertisement and publicity and things like that. But hopefully it will happen. It's just with startup companies, it takes time. It takes time. You know, I've got my dad always saying, well, what are you doing? You know, you're not earning any money from this and blah, blah. And, you know, and it is hard, man. It's hard to survive. But I know, you know, when you believe in something and you know that it will work out because I'm onto something and everyone has said that I am and that what I'm doing is really good. And I feel it. You know, I get more pleasure out of seeing someone transform into the better than I did on any bloody reality show. You know what I mean?
Oh, mate, yeah, it's lovely. What would you like to, you know, as it grows and builds? Because I'm sure it will. What would you like to do with it, mate? Have you got like plans further down the road?
I'd like to do some shows to take a production that they've achieved to do in a theatre. So invite people to come and then buy tickets, and hopefully that money would go to the charity, and it would also help me open more centres around the nation and help up north and do more community projects with Morning After Drama, because there's so many places that I can hit. And also, like, I want to do, like, this is my little idea, I want to do old age homes. Because I know that the oldies, right, they're sitting there and I know they'd be great. They'd love to do a bit of acting and a bit of theatre because it would really bring them out themselves and have a laugh. And I think they'd be excellent. So that's going to be a little mission.
I think that's a wonderful idea. Yeah. I think a lot of the place that, you know, the retirement communities and the homes and stuff, I think they have a lot of like the same sort of stuff as well. Yeah. So to have something so different, that would really add a lot of sort of light to someone's day. Yeah, what a wonderful idea, mate.
You come in drama. Come on, love. all right, Sid, I'll be there in a minute. You know, and then they love it and they feel good and they look forward to it. And, you know, so my mate's a recruitment guy and he's going to get onto it. He thinks it's genius.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the 12 steps. I've come up with an idea of doing 12-step drama. So, but basically, instead of, you know, where you write the steps out and everything, or you do it with a sponsor, to help people in rehabs by acting it out. So step one, powerless and unmanageability. Well, let's act out a scenario when you were powerless and your life became unmanageable. Step two, you know, a power greater than that, restore us to sanity. Well, let's do a scene where you did something thinking you were going to get a different result and it didn't. And you got the same result, but you need to be restored to sanity, you know, and the amends process when you're saying sorry and you're right and your wrongs. There's so many steps that you can, or most of them, that you can act out. And then it gives them more of an idea when they do go to do it with a sponsor of what the steps are about. Because sometimes when you're in rehab and then you hear you've got to go meetings and this is just the beginning and you've got to do step work, they think, work? I don't want to do no written work. Work? Oh, my God. I just want to be clean. You know, and it's like, well, this is a way of explaining it a bit better.
Yeah, definitely. Was that how you did you find it like that, Paul, when that was first suggested to you about like 12 steps and stuff? Did you feel a bit sort of...
I was like flipping out because I suppose my ADHD, I just don't like to have to write loads of questions out and do a lot of work and all of that. I just like rather... So I kind of choose sponsors where we're like more likely to just talk about stuff. But when you have a step four, you do have to write out your resentments and your fears and your, you know, or it's step four is a personal inventory, an inventory of all the things that you've resented and people. And you look at it and you realize that actually you have a part to play in all of it. I have a part to play in all of it, even though I've blamed them for years. You know, I still have a part. And when it comes to abuse or anything like that, the only part I have to play with it is that I'm still hanging on to it and I'm still hurting myself by doing that. And it's about forgiveness, you know. So there's lots of things where you think, fuck that, I wasn't wrong, I didn't do nothing. But there is always a way of looking at it. And when you see that, it kind of makes you feel a bit better and less resentful, because resentment is the number one offender. And it's the one that makes us use again, you know, when we're hating on people or angry, you know, because of this or because of that. It makes addicts want to go and take something.
Yeah, it's so hard. It's hard carrying that around all the time.
Yeah, we have to not carry that stuff. You know, we have to try and relieve ourselves of that. And be spiritual and be good to people, be kind, you know, and all of that stuff. You know, I do a lot of stuff with Flagstock for Caroline.
Yeah, that's on my list to ask you about that, actually, mate, because I've seen that, you know, the clips of you announcing things on stage and stuff like that. That must be lovely to be a part of that.
Yeah, they get me. I'm the only one that they let go up there and talk about addiction and mental health and just to chat to the crowd, really. It's nice that they allow me to have that 5 minutes. There's a lot I'd like to say up there. You kind of have to contain it a bit. And then I'll introduce someone. Last year was Matt Goss, I think. And the year before was Louise. It's great. There's a lot of people there. It's nice to see that they're doing something in aid of Caroline. I think she'd be really proud. You know, and that's the thing, man. She had too much pride. She didn't ask for help. And if she would have, because she was an addict too, she had stuff like just like us. And she never got the help because I suppose she had too much pride. She didn't want anyone to know, because the fear is, if you're in that high up, you think if people know that I'm drinking or self-harming or depressed, I'm going to lose my job. They won't let me work. And her going to court and all that, I think, made her really scared that she'd lose her whole life. So what's the point of living? Fucking terrible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, isn't it? It's heartbreaking. And you can see how easy it happens, and you can see how easy, like, it doesn't really matter what you do for a job, if you're worried that you're going to lose it by asking for help, then, it's super sad, man.
There's a lot of pride there. And it's like, do you know what? 9 times out of 10, they actually would do the opposite. Instead of firing you, they'd help you.
Yeah, it's so true. You find that, don't you, when you start speaking about like your own mental health, you know? I think like, you know, I was thinking a bit just about what I know about yourself, you know, in the build up to this conversation. And I think, you know, part of the reason for your longevity, right, while you're still, you know, while you're still here is because of your openness and your honesty. And I think people really like connect with that. And it's easy to think when you're going through something, it's really easy to think that it's going to push people away. But in reality, once you start talking, like the opposite happens. Do you know what I mean? It brings people closer.
It's so amazing. And that's why I carried on being that way, because I wasn't like that. I was completely the opposite. I was closed book. I didn't want to say anything. I didn't want people to know that I was fucked. I just totally was holding it all in. But in the end, I realized that, look, and it's Robbie Williams I have to thank for it, really, because I saw that he told everyone everything. And he did it because he said, well, then the press have got nothing on me. You know, what are they going to say? I've told everything. So he was so open, and I thought, wow, that's amazing. And that kind of really made me think, well, maybe I should. And one time I was in the Priory, and I did an episode from there, and it was the Caroline Flack episode, I think. I was doing also, they were letting me out each night to do a play in the West End called Time. And Mark said, do you want to do an episode? I said, yeah, I'll do. He said, well, we'll pretend you're somewhere else. I said, no, I'm going to tell him I'm here. And I did. And I was really open. And I just said, I'm struggling at the moment. I'm in the Priory. Da, da, da. And the amount of love and the amount of kind of the opposite to what you'd think would happen. People go, oh, no, fuck him. He's a loser. No, it wasn't. It wasn't like that. It was just like, you've got to be brave to do it. Because it is private, but at the same time, I'm not doing it to get old poor Paul or anything like that. I'm doing it because I don't want to lie anymore. I don't want to pretend that I'm okay when I'm not.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. And it is so empowering, you know, and like you say, it brings people in, and you do get that love back from people. And it's the hardest thing to do, because your poorly brain lies to you, right? Like when you're in a good place and you think about how you thought about yourself when you were in a bad place, it's like there's so much lies that when you're well, you can look back and go, that wasn't true. I was lying to myself. When you're in it, it's like you can't see the wood from the tree.
No, you can't. It's like blinded by love and stuff like that. And you think, what? I didn't even, you know, but it's totally true. Your head tells you lies, especially when you're in the madness. Go on, mate. Go, yeah. That'll be nice. Like that'd be good to go and take that, or that'd be good to go and, you know, whatever. And you do it. And you realize, or they don't want you, and it's just whatever, it's just a lie. And you realize, like, that was the worst idea in the world. So it's basically my advice to most people is do the opposite. Do the opposite to what your head tells you. No matter what, when you're in this shit, do the opposite. Don't listen to your head. If your head's telling you you're a piece of shit, you're not. You're loved, you're amazing. And, you know, you have to keep that little light on, even if it's really small and just flickering. At least there's a light, and it will get brighter. It will get brighter, and that window will open more. But keep it open, that window of opportunity to get help or to stay well. Because the minute you go back downhill, it will close and that light will start to go off. But more you do the good stuff and you do the opposite to what your head tells you, which is why they have step three, which is all about turning your will and your life over to the care of a higher power. Because there is something bigger than us out there. There's something that saved me. I should have been dead ages ago, you know, but I'm not. For a reason, maybe that I'm meant to be here, you know. So there's something out there, the star, the moon, the you know, what brings up the sun, you know, something bigger than us. So whatever it is, even if it's just, you know, anything, your grandpa that passed away or whatever, you know, you just have to have a higher power and you turn it over to them. But you meet them halfway, because so when I go out the door, it's not my decision. I don't make the decision. They do. So what's, and in a way, it's like, well, how do they tell you? Well, you just basically you know what's right and what's wrong. And that little instinct inside you, that little kind of gut feeling is what you go with, not what your head's saying.
Yeah, I love that, mate.
Because that little thing inside you that, you know, everyone goes, oh, I knew I should have done it because I had this feeling, but I didn't go with it. I fucking ignored it. Well, that's your intuition. And you know what that is? That's God. That's for me anyway.
Yeah, that's it. Because, you know, God can be whatever
it could be anything. You know, is that power that's trying to say, don't fucking do it, mate.
Yeah. And when people are poorly, your world just gets so small, doesn't it? It shrinks and you forget that you are part of something bigger. And again, things like going to your weekly meeting at the drama club to go and like see your mate and just realize you are part of a community and part of something bigger than yourself. Again, it all feeds that whole thing, doesn't it? Of keeping people.
Last week I had someone, he said, Paul, I didn't want to go. My head was telling me, don't come, don't come. They don't like me. I'm a shit actor, blah, blah, blah. But he pushed himself and I said, wow, amazing. And he said, and he realized how much people love him there, how much we all want him there and how good he is. And at the end of it, he went, I'm so glad I've come. I'm so glad I didn't listen to my head. And you know what? There's a thing scientifically, I'll end on this, that basically has been proven in the brain. There's been a lot of results. I posted it the other day that there is this thing called the, I want to get it right. I'll message you it, but maybe you could put it on the thing.
I'll put it in the notes, for sure.
And it's something, and I'll give you the link. It's so amazing. And what it is if you do stuff that you don't want to do, and it has to be stuff you don't want to do, like him coming to drama, but he didn't want to go, and it's good for you, but you don't want to do it, that part of the brain grows. And by it growing, helps you live longer because it's big in athletes, it's big in people that have overcome stuff, it's small in obese people, but when you go on a diet it gets bigger, and the people that live really long, it stays the same size, this part of the brain. But what they're calling it is not willpower, they're calling it like the will to live. And that will to live is by doing stuff you don't want to do that's good for you, that will help you stay because you want to live. So you want to, you know it's good for you, but you don't want to do it. The last thing you want to do is go to that fucking meeting or go to the gym or go on that diet, but you do it. That part of the brain will grow and you will live longer. But you need to keep feeding that because the minute you start enjoying it and you want to go, or you didn't want to go before, but you enjoy it, it gets smaller. So you have to keep doing things that you've done. So it's hard.
Yeah, keep challenging yourself and keep pushing yourself. And love that, Maze. Yeah, that's really, really lovely. Yeah.
Going against the grain. So, you know, and I do that all the time because I don't want to go and teach these people when I'm depressed and down and feeling like shit. But I go because I know it's good for them and it's good for me. And, you know, but there's a lot of things I don't look forward to. You know, it won't grow today because I wanted to do this podcast.
Well, I appreciate that, mate. Yeah. So at the end of this, at least if your brain stayed the same size, we'll take it, mate.
I'll take that.
Oh, mate. Paul, thank you so much for your time today, mate. It's been so lovely to chat. And I love what you're doing. I think it's just, it's so cool. And just lovely to hear all about it, mate.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And, you know, if anyone wants to get in touch, you know, just paul@morningafterdrama.com or just go to morningafterdrama.com. And I'm on Instagram at Paul Danan or TikTok and Paulie Danan with an L, with a Y on Twitter and stuff. But if anyone's got any problems, I'm more than happy to answer their stuff on my socials and help them as much as I can. I always respond. And I know a lot of people usually don't, but I do because I know how tough it can be. Just thank you, Tom. Thank you for what you're doing because you're amazing, mate.
Oh, mate, thank you. Right back at you. And I'll put all those links in the episode notes. Thank you.
Awesome. All right. We'll be right back.
to big up to the Proper Mental Podcast. The Proper Mental Podcast.